We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Watchdogs noted that the investment came after Kushner used his position in the White House to advance Saudi interest and shield the regime from accountability for the Khashoggi murder. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, His Cash Again. Kushner firm gets $2 billion from Saudi fund run by Crown Prince. Stay tuned for more. A private equity firm created by former White House advisor and Trump son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has reportedly secured a $2 billion investment from a sovereign wealth fund directed by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a deal that watchdog groups and lawmakers viewed as part of Kushner's effort to cash in on his favorable treatment of the brutal Saudi regime. The New York Times reported recently that Kushner's new firm, Affinity Partners, netted the investment 6 months after the end of the Trump administration, despite objections from the Saudi fund's advisors about the merits of the deal, heightening suspicions that the money is paid back for Kushner's defense of bin Salman in the wake of the gruesome 2018 murder of Jamal Khashoggi. The United Nations and U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that bin Salman, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, likely approved the Khashoggi assassination. As a top aide to Donald Trump, Jared Kushner spent years building ties and currying favor with Saudi Arabia, said Noah Bookbinder, the president of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, in response to the Times' story, adding, "It's no surprise that an investment fund tied to the Saudi crown prince invested billions in Kushner's fund, even though advisors raised objections." Journalist Jude Legum added on Twitter, "Let's be very clear. Jared Kushner used his position in the White House to advance Saudi interests, including making sure Saudi wouldn't be held accountable for the brutal murder of a U.S.-based journalist," Legum wrote, "and now he is cashing in." According to The Times, the objections raised by the Saudi Fund's advisory panel included the inexperience of the Affinity Fund management, the possibility that the kingdom would be responsible for the bulk of the investment and risk, due diligence on the fledgling firm's operations that found them unsatisfactory in all aspects, a proposed asset management fee that seems excessive, and public relations risks from Mr. Kushner's prior role as a senior advisor to his father-in-law. But days after the panel outlined its concerns, the full board of the $620 billion fund, which the Times notes is led by Ben Salman, dismissed them and signed off on the investment in Kushner's firm. The Times also revealed that Kushner was not the only official from Trump's White House to receive Saudi money after the former president was voted out of office in 2020. Former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin's new private equity firm, Liberty Strategic Capital, has received $1 billion from the same Saudi fund that invested in Kushner's outfit. The Saudi fund agreed to invest twice as much and on more generous terms with Mr. Kushner than it did at about the same time with former Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Even though Mr. Mnuchin had a record as a successful investor before entering government, the Times noted. Despite public outcry over the regime's continued human rights abuses, a spokesperson for Kushner's firm told The Times that it is proud to have the Saudi fund as an investor. Affinity's latest public filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission show that the firm's primary fund has $2.5 billion under management, the bulk of which appears to be from Saudi Arabia. The Times report, which came as Trump is gearing up for another presidential bid in 2024, drew the attention of at least one U.S. senator. Senator Chris Murphy, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, tweeted, "Just because the breathtaking corruption occurs in public doesn't make it not breathtaking."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report released by Iran's Nur News website on Monday says undercover Israeli military personnel deployed to U.S. bases in the region are conducted their own missions independent of American forces present in those bases. The report says the important point about regional presence is the deployment of undercover military and intelligence agents of Israel in some regional countries that enjoy close relations with Iran. Experts believe that the main goal behind the presence of the Israeli agents in some regional countries is to spy on and collect direct information related to Iran's important bases and sensitive facilities.
It's a very dangerous precedent. What we now know is that the IDF and the Zionist regime's different intelligence units like Mossad are working within Central Command, are working alongside U.S. Forces, NATO forces, and their allies, the Gulf states in the region. And they are their main focus is to control what's going on in the region and ultimately to fight against Iran. And this is a dangerous escalation. And we've seen it now over the past few years. First with the United States removal from the JCPOA, the brutal assassination of General Soleimani, and the increasing hawkish nature of U.S. foreign policy.
The report notes that although the Iranian armed forces are closely monitoring these provocative moves, for which the host countries are also responsible, the nature of these actions will increase tension and instability in the region and can lead to unpredictable conditions. It added that high-resolution documented photos are available on the presence of Israeli regime's aircraft and espionage equipment in the U.S. bases in some regional countries, which confirmed the intelligence gathered in the field on Israel's anti-Iran activities in the region. According to the new report, senior officials of countries where Israeli undercover experts have been present have been aware of the Israeli military and intelligence presence in their countries, but prefer to keep silent. The project started when Israel was transferred from the United States European Command, EUCOM, to U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, in order to enable the Tel Aviv regime to carry out its intelligence and military conspiracies in West Asia following the withdrawal of the United States from the region. While some believe the normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has laid the groundwork for and provided Tel Aviv with a pretext to conduct its operations close to Iranian borders, others say the U.S. is assigning tasks to Israel to carry out in its stead in the region.
Their main focus is on Iran, and they are having in the region allies like Arab Gulf states and others who are focused on this. And secondly, it's to help the United States, who sees China as a threat because China and Iran's close ties and now their alliance is a threat to U.S. Zionist stability and their control in the region. So I think that what we see here is the move to Central Command is primarily against Iran, but also undergirding that from the United States is Iran's relationship with China.
Iran has shown that it won't stand idly by in the face of foreign aggression. The January 2020 attack on the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq housing U.S. troops is one example. Iran carried out the retaliatory missile attack in the aftermath of the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's deputy commander of the Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in Baghdad. Iranian officials have, on so many occasions, noted that the Islamic Republic won't tolerate the presence of Israel in the region, highlighting the threats that the Israeli regime poses to the regional nations. Will they heed the warnings? Only time can tell.
Al-Hawl camp is located 15 kilometers away from the Syrian-Iraqi border. It is the largest camp of Daesh elements and is controlled by the U.S.-affiliated Syrian Democratic Forces. The militants are holding tens of thousands of people in Al-Hawl camp, East Hasaka City. They run it in cooperation with U.S. occupation forces, including thousands of Daesh terrorists of different nationalities and their families, whom Washington invests and employs to implement its plans in the region. Meanwhile, Iraq's National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, has expressed concern about the possibility of the release of Daesh elements and leaders from prisons controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in eastern Syria. He says Daesh has made numerous attempts to break such prisons since most of the terrorist group's leaders are incarcerated there. He has frequently met with U.S. officials and United Nations envoys to stress the need to resolve the issue of the Al-Hawl refugee camp in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. The senior Iraqi official called on foreign governments to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hawl and urged a rapid dismantlement of the camp. Daesh began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swathes in lightning attacks. Iraq declared victory over Daesh in December 2017 after a three-year counter-terrorism military campaign, which also had the support of neighboring Iran. The remnants, though, keep staging sporadic attacks across Iraq, attempting to regroup and unleash fresh violence. Daesh has intensified its terrorist attacks in Iraq since January 2020, when the United States assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes, near Baghdad International Airport. The Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups have repeatedly warned Baghdad that the remnants of Daesh active in Syria's U.S.-occupied east may find unhindered access to the Iraqi border and infiltrate into its western Anbar province. This is while the positions of the PMU and its affiliated resistance groups operating against Daesh in the border regions have repeatedly come under attack by the U.S. military over the past years.
The United States funnels money into these groups, into these very kind of ethno-nationalist and separatist organizations that are against the current government of, in this case, Syria. And of course, the government of Syria happens to be very anti-U.S. So naturally, the United States is going to fund groups that want to topple the government of a given country that opposes NATO, that opposes to the West, that opposes U.S. dominance.
The U.S. military has stationed forces and military equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the unlawful deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in Syria for its oil. Additionally, security conditions have been deteriorating in the areas under the control of U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in Syria's northern and northeastern provinces of Raqqa, Hasaka, and Deir ez-Zor.
The Assads, Hafez and Bashar al-Assad, who have been the last two presidents of Syria, have not allowed the United States or the corporations of the West to come into the country and buy up the oil companies and began allowing Shell and British Petroleum and the other major oil monopolies to come into Syria and to steal the natural resources that rightly belong to the Syrian nation, to the Syrian government and their people. And so as a result, the United States has decided, with the backing of NATO and Western European powers, that the only option at this point is either a full invasion of Syria to topple the Assad government, which would be absolutely disastrous and have horrible repercussions for the United States and the West on a geopolitical scale.
Local Syrians complain that U.S.-backed militants' constant raids have generated a state of frustration and instability, severely affecting their businesses and livelihood. Residents accuse the U.S.-sponsored militants of stealing crude oil. Local council affiliated with the militants also stand accused of financial corruption. France's 2022 presidential vote is divided into two rounds, a free-for-all and a runoff vote between the top two contenders. 12 candidates ranging from the far right to the far left are running for this election. If a candidate secures over half of the total vote, they will directly win the election, but this hasn't happened since Charles de Gaulle's re-election in 1965. Otherwise, only the top two candidates make it through to the second round, and whoever wins that round will be the new French president for a five-year term. President Emmanuel Macron is seeking to become the first incumbent to win re-election since Jacques Chirac in 2002. He is vowing to continue to decrease taxes, raise the pension age to 65, and get France to full employment after decades of mass joblessness. But Macron entered the race late, and his second term is facing a real threat from far-right candidate Marine Le Pen, as polls show a closing of the gap between the incumbent and his main rival. Le Pen was the runner-up in the 2017 elections. This will be her third attempt at the presidency. She's a key far-right figure and the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, who founded France's National Front and is notorious for his racist, anti-immigrant views. Le Pen has focused on the cost of living crisis, while her anti-immigration program would ban the Muslim headscarf from all public places. Voters have complained of a lack of new political ideas or vision, and few solutions to their problems, including purchasing power and the high cost of living, healthcare, and the fight against climate change. There have been fewer rallies, and voters have complained there was no direct TV debate between all candidates. As a result, an unprecedented number of French voters say they are unsure who to vote for, particularly young and low-income voters. Voter turnout has decreased from 84% in 2007 to about 78% in 2017, and it is believed that abstention may be even higher this time. A low turnout could have a major impact on the vote. France's 2022 presidential election is unlike the previous ones. That's mainly due to the events that have taken place in the political and social scene of France in recent years and intensified the pressure on minorities such as Muslims and immigrants. For Muslims, the election of Emmanuel Macron was supposed to provide relief after 5 years of François Hollande. However, Macron's first term has been gloomy for French Muslims. Many French Muslims no longer see him as the centrist that he claimed to be in 2017, particularly due to the adoption of the separatism law in the summer of 2021. The government claims its legislation is intended to strengthen France's secular system. Critics, however, say it unfairly singles out the Muslim community and restricts religious freedom. France has been criticized by international organizations and NGOs, especially the UN, for targeting and marginalizing Muslims with the law. Since February 2018, France has controlled nearly 25,000 mosques, schools, associations, and workplaces and closed 718 of them, including over 20 mosques.
France, like many other European and Western nations, is going through ever-increasing Islamophobia and environment of hate against Muslims. And the reality is that this environment is escalating by politicians and by media and by the policies of otherization, i.e. targeting Muslims as the reason and the problems for everything whatsoever.
The alleged centrist Macron has no solution for France's anti-Muslim problems. And in case far-right Le Pen replaces him, things are probably not going to change for the better. Therefore, French Muslims have a choice to make: abstention or taking a chance on a left candidate.
Tel Aviv has been the scene of yet another Palestinian operation. On Thursday, a Palestinian man opened fire at Israelis in the heart of a city, killing three and injuring eight others. He was shot dead by Israeli forces after a nine-hour manhunt. Palestinian resistance groups praised the attack as a heroic operation, calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes. The Popular Resistance Committee, a coalition of a number of armed Palestinian groups, says the operation exposed the regime's fragility and weakness. The comments were echoed by Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, which hailed the recent shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Thursday's attack was the fourth such operation in the past 2 weeks. Late last month, a Palestinian shooting operation killed five people in a Tel Aviv suburb. Attacks in the northern city of Hadera and the southern city of Beersheba had killed six Israelis days earlier. But the question is, what's behind the uptick in the number of attacks that's been described as one of the deadliest waves of Palestinian operations in years?
We are suffering daily from their homes being confiscated, their lives being taken, children being arrested on an almost daily basis and taken off to jail. So for every action, there is a reaction, and repression builds resistance. So I think we are seeing an outcry of despair, but also a strengthening of resistance. against the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank.
As tensions mount in the occupied territories, Israel is bracing for more Palestinian operations in the days to come. The events that are unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of hostilities that culminated in the 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, during which over 250 Palestinians, including scores of women and children, were killed in the besieged enclave. The international community called for an immediate end to the war, but stopped short of condemning Israel for the deadly and devastating onslaught after it was over. The world also seems to have turned a blind eye to Israel's land grab and expansionist policies that see hundreds of Palestinian-owned structures razed to the ground every year. The years-long blockade on Gaza Strip, settlers' violence against Palestinians, and Israel's illegal settlement construction activities also seem to be going unnoticed. When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering.
You've mentioned all the usual suspects who give political coverage and the fig leaf of respectability to the apartheid Israeli regime, remembering that Israel is a white colonial European colonization project within the Middle East. But you've left out the other group of people, the other organization that have condemned Palestinian violence, but have not condemned Israeli violence, and that is the Palestinian Authority, which is led by the unelected Mahmoud Abbas. So while all these other people are held to account for their failure to hold to account Israeli apartheid atrocities and war crimes, let us not forget the PA, and Mahmoud Abbas.
In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. In a hard war, one cannot fight with the use of old weapons. The hardware parts of the issue are accessible, but the important part is the software one. The weapon of clarification contains an important software part. There is a room for innovation, new ideas, and new methods in this area. In my opinion, what can function as an efficient weapon today is the clarification of lofty Islamic values in different areas. There are many things to be said in the area of ideological and religious matters. We have many attractive and delightful ideas for the world. There are many things that have been left unsaid in matters related to Islamic lifestyle. Examples include Islamic viewpoints on the environment, treatment of animals and family. These things constitute lifestyle. Islam has many attractive ideas in all these areas. There are Islamic teachings that can be derived from the Islamic text and offered to everyone. There are many things to be said in the area of Islamic government too. An important issue that can be brought up is Islamic government.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Government in Islamic logic is radically different from the common government in the world. It is not similar to monarchy, nor is it similar to today's presidential systems, to military governments, and to coup-based rulers. It is not similar to any of these. It is a unique form of government based on spiritual principles. The Islamic way of ruling is based on popularity, religiousness, ideology, and refusal to be aristocratic, extravagant, and oppressive. It promotes neither preparation nor acceptance of oppression. No one oppresses me because you are capable of counteracting it, and I will not oppress anyone because you are capable of preventing me from oppression. This is Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, Dua number 20. This exists in one prayer in Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah. Each and every word of these teachings contain important ideological issues. These are things that constitute our new weapons, and we must benefit from them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Me from all the
in the limelight.
Our data show that global emissions continue to move in the wrong direction at a rapid pace. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA Administrator Rick Spinard said in a statement, adding, "The evidence is consistent, alarming, and undeniable." Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, NOAA says atmospheric methane levels set new record in 2021. Stay tuned for more. Climate scientists have recently stressed the need for urgent action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions following new data showing a record increase in atmospheric methane levels for a second consecutive year. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA Administrator Rick Spinard said in a statement, "Our data show that global emissions continue to move in the wrong direction at a rapid pace. The evidence is consistent, alarming, and undeniable." As NOAA notes, carbon dioxide remains the biggest climate change threat. However, scientists say that reducing methane emissions, the largest anthropogenic sources of which are animal agriculture and energy production, is relatively easy. Spinard said that reducing methane emissions is an important tool we can use right now to lessen the impacts of climate change in the near term and rapidly reduce the rate of warming. Let's not forget that methane also contributes to ground-level ozone formation, which causes roughly 500,000 premature deaths each year around the world. Casey Siegel, director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute, said that this report is especially alarming because if carbon dioxide is the fossil fuel broiler of our heating planet, methane is a blowtorch with 87 times more short-term heating power. Yet despite methane reductions being a relatively cheap and easy way to get phenomenal climate benefits, the industry has fought regulations at every turn. Polluters' record profits must be used to properly seal and remediate every well and fix every methane leak, she added. But methane reductions have to be one part of a transformative global effort to phase out deadly fossil fuels in favor of truly clean, renewable energy. Anything less puts us on a catastrophic path to an unrecognizable world. According to NOAA, preliminary analysis showed the annual increase in atmospheric methane during 2021 was 17 parts per billion, the largest annual increase recorded since systematic measurements began in 1983. The increase during 2020 was 15.3 ppb. Atmospheric methane levels averaged 1,895.7 ppb during 2021, or around 162% greater than pre-industrial levels. From NOAA's observations, scientists estimate global methane emissions in 2021 are 15% higher than the 1984 to 2006 period. Meanwhile, levels of carbon dioxide also continue to increase at historically high levels. The global surface average for carbon dioxide during 2021 was 414.7 parts per million, which is an increase of 2.66 ppm over the 2020 average. This marks the 10th consecutive year that carbon dioxide increased by more than 2 parts per million, which represents the fastest sustained rate of increase in 63 years since monitoring began. Scientists fear soaring concentrations of methane, which is up to 87 times more potent than CO2 over a 20-year period, may have triggered a potentially irreversible climate feed loop. Critics call the 30% target a step in the right direction, but insufficient to adequately address the emissions crisis. The International Energy Agency said last October that a 75% reduction in methane emissions by 2030 is essential to combating the climate emergency.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, it's horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID, and now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighbouring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Britain has made its pro-Ukraine stance clear, with the flag of Kiev fluttering atop several government buildings in Whitehall. Yet it was still a surprise when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson popped up alongside Vladimir Zelensky for a walkabout in the near-deserted streets of the Ukrainian capital. The mutual political backslapping seems at odds with the reality of the crisis, but Johnson pledged further military support, including 120 armored vehicles and anti-ship missile systems.
Together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify week by week the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons.
Back in London, the optics were not as glossy.
Well, I think Boris Johnson is engaging in a propaganda exercise designed to manufacture consent for prolonging a war, which a proxy war, that is, which is unwinnable. And rather than indulging in this sort of publicity exercise, he ought to be focusing, in my opinion, on diplomacy to bring the war to an end.
Boris Johnson has pledged further support to Kiev in the shape of military hardware and by ramping up the anti-Russian action. It's also been mentioned that the Prime Minister might have taken this crisis as an opportunity to bolster his conflict credentials. But what of the voices urging a de-escalation and not adding fuel to this international fire? Well, many argue they won't be found here in the corridors of British power. Britain's role in the conflict, especially its supply of more armaments, has not brought the result it perhaps hoped.
Well, it doesn't help the people of Ukraine, and nor does it help the people in this country, or indeed across Europe. The strategy which is being pursued by NATO is entirely counterproductive. I mean, they're heading potentially towards a wider conflagration, maybe a third world war.
At the heart of this conflict is a wider issue, one Zelensky reminded Johnson.
If we were in NATO, this war wouldn't have happened. Or it would have unfolded differently. You would have the shoulder of close neighbours, strong neighbours, or we could all fight together. And probably war would not happen.
Until real diplomacy prevails with Moscow and Kiev thrashing out their regional affairs, publicity tours like the ones undertaken by Britain's Prime Minister will only do so much. Amina Taylor, London.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the northern West Bank city of Jenin in the last few days. Israeli forces have shot dead several Palestinians in separate incidents, including two women in less than 24 hours. On Monday, 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. This came as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has granted all military and security forces full freedom of operation. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs considered Bennett's statement as an order to kill Palestinians.
It's an order to kill. It's a war crime, actually, and a crime against humanity of the Palestinian people. Israel is trying now to escalate the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory to consolidate its apartheid and colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory using all the illegal measures, including the extrajudicial killing.
As Israeli forces continue raiding Jenin and the surrounding towns, Palestinian resistance groups in the city announced a state of alert and called for general mobilization of their activists to confront the Israeli military incursion. Protests have also been held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with Jenin and its residents. Moreover, the Israeli military forces have maintained their presence across the occupied West Bank. Experts warn that they will also escalate a crackdown against Palestinians and use even more excessive force to fight the Palestinian resistance.
We are facing an escalation of events. The smell of a new intifada rises. Numerous funerals for Palestinians in several areas due to clashes taking place in friction points and sites. One can tell an escalation is expected on all fronts, which might then lead to the return of calm.
Tel Aviv has been stunned by a string of deadly operations in the last weeks. 14 Israelis, including soldiers, have been killed. Since then, tensions have risen sharply. The Israeli army has stepped up its daily raids and arrests in an attempt to crack down on the spiraling violence.
It's obvious that Tel Aviv is heading toward another heavy-handed crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories and specifically in Jenin. But Palestinians who have been confronting military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, thousands of Palestinians, including around 500 administrative detainees, are behind bars in Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A glimpse into Iran's capabilities in the nuclear industry. This exhibition showcases the latest made-in-Iran nuclear products, ranging from radiopharmaceuticals to plasma therapy for cancer patients. Among them is Gallofabi, a radiomedicine used in the efficient diagnosis of cancer. Its developers say it is an outstanding achievement in the nuclear sector. For security reasons, we cannot show the experts' faces. The exhibition comes as part of ceremonies marking the National Day of Nuclear Technology, which falls on April 9th. It commemorates Iran's first enrichment of uranium at an industrial scale in 2006. In addition to the 77 new achievements displayed here, on Saturday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi unveiled what he called a comprehensive strategic document for nuclear development. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the document provides a roadmap for the country's nuclear program in the next two decades. Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry, it has always been haunted by sanctions. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was signed between Iran and the world powers, which promised a sanctions relief for the country in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The U.S.